So this is the Rod's.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this October 27th meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. Welcome all who are here and those on the phone. Senator Winters and Representative Parrish won't be able to be with us today, but let's go around and introduce ourselves. I see that we have several sit-ins here, so we're not engaging in a sit-in. We just have some people sitting in for other people. Right? I'm Michael Denbrough. I'm the task force chair. I represent Senate District 23. That's northeast and southeast Portland. And here in the legislature, I chair the Workforce Committee.
I'm Lou Frederick. I'm state representative from District 43. That's north and northeast Portland. And I am on several committees, but I'm most interested in what we do out of this task force right now. There's several bills I'm curious about.
Thank you.
I'm Paul Solomon. I'm the executive director of sponsors in Lane County Reentry Program and chair of Lane County's Public Safety Coordinating Council.
Ross Caldwell from the Criminal Justice Commission. I'm sitting in for Mike Schmidt.
Welcome, Ross.
Jen Netherwood. I'm an instructor with the Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute.
Scott Taylor. I'm the director of Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm sitting in for Truls Neal for Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors.
Thanks for being here, Scott.
I'm Brian Jed, Mercy Corps Northwest Program Manager for the Reentry Transition Center in Portland.
Jim Booker, I'm the Federal Program Manager for the Oregon Employment Department.
Hi, Cindy Booth, Oregon Department of Corrections, Reentry and Release. Marie Garcia, Oregon Department of Corrections, Legislative and Government Relations Manager.
Andrea Fulton, Legislative and Public Affairs with the Oregon Employment Department.
This is getting in order, and I think we need to completely change the way we do things.
And on the phone, who do we have?
Deborah Yipsey, Executive Director of Multifamily Northwest.
Oh, hey, Deborah. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Eddie Alves of the Church Valley Community College.
Okay, Eddie, how's it going out there?
That's good.
Great. Anybody else on the phone?
This is Nova
Sweet.
I'm with the Family Preservation Project.
Hey, Nova. Great.
Hi. I'm Kylie
Grinnell
with the YWCA and the
Family
Preservation Project as well.
Okay, great, Kylie. Good. Okay. All right, great. Did anybody come in? Oh. Who are you, ma'am?
Lisa Trawernicht.
No, Lisa.
Oh, sorry.
Elizabeth Kushner.
I meant Elizabeth.
Children First for Oregon.
Great. Okay, for today's meeting, we don't have any formal presentations. The purpose of today's meeting is to have a kind of work session to talk about the bill concepts, or some of the bill concepts that are out there that have been provoked by the work of this task force, as well as others that may be out there. And for us to discuss them, see who the appropriate partners might be, which of these you all might be particularly interested in as we're working on developing these concepts, any further ideas or concerns that you might have about any of them. And then anything that we're missing at this point. We're going to spend the first part and probably the bulk of this meeting doing that. And then we're going to start talking about the report of this coming out of this task force. That's, part of the work of this task force is to report on the problem of reentry and the challenges and what we've learned, what we've come up with, what we've identified as areas for further work. To make recommendations. So that will be Cheyenne's job, is going to be producing that report. And so I want to take time for us to talk about what we have learned and what we think should go into this report. So we have a lot of people writing for us. We have legislative counsel writing bills right now for us, and they are they were given, for the most part, pretty broad concepts, and over the next month or two they're going to be evolving them. And so your feedback will really be helpful for it. So what we've distributed to you, and it's being put on OLIS for those of you who are on the phone, is a list of the bills that I put in provoked by the work of this task force. And just go over them quickly, and then we'll kind of look at them one by one. The first is to remove the sunset on this task force. I think, you know, for me, one of the real takeaways is what a complex area this is. And, you know, especially as we're looking at the area of court fees and fines, there is a lot more work to be done, because we're dealing with multiple jurisdictions, multiple situations, you know, et cetera. So, you know, there may be, hopefully there will be, some things we can do in this session, but this is work that I think is clearly going to be ongoing, and as well as other areas. And so I believe that this task force should continue, but we can talk about that. The second one is the issue of driver's license suspension reform, which we've talked about. The third was certificates of rehabilitation, or certificates of restoration of opportunity, or whatever we call them. The fourth was the Bill of Rights for the children of incarcerated parents. The fifth is expanding the Family Preservation Project, which we restored some funding to them at the last session. I think there's a sense that there's more work to be done there, and so expanding the scope of that project is the goal of the fifth bill. And the sixth bill has to do with that subject of pre-entry that we heard about last time, where there would be we would create a pilot project, a kind of demonstration project, for a statewide pre-entry program where people who were about to enter the system would make sure that all their affairs are in order before they enter. There was actually a seventh bill that I put in, and you know, I should tell you these all went in sort of the last half hour of just before the deadline. This was a real flurry. But we also heard about some challenges with respect to apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship. And I put in a bill proposal that was related to the restoration of driving for people who were in apprenticeship programs. Now, we've learned that we may not need that piece of legislation, that the existing bill, the existing statute that we passed back in 2013 or 2011, I forget when it was, 2013, actually covers apprenticeship as well as pre-apprenticeship. However, I've learned that the rules have yet to be fully drafted on that, and there's a lot of work still to be done there. But whether or not we need another bill, the bill is there if we need it. We may not need it. We may just need to really focus on getting that rulemaking done. So Okay, so let's move back, and the first bill, the removal of the sunset. Does that make sense to you all?
Yes. You want verbal, so you have it on record.
Yeah. No, all we need is sort of a general sense here. Okay. Something that we'll want to think about is, are there changes to the makeup of the bill, of the task force that should be called out in the statute? And so something that I'd ask you to do, sort of as a homework assignment, is to take a look at the bill that created this task force, Senate Bill 969, and who it calls out as being part. And, if you have a sense that there are any important populations that are not included here that should be included, we can amend 969 to include them. And I guess, are there any that come immediately to mind for you? Any groups that may be missing? We haven't, the 969 didn't specifically ask for representation from ex-offenders themselves. We have been fortunate to have a couple of members of this task force who come out of that background. We may want to make that explicit in the bill. That's the one thing offhand that I that comes to me. Scott?
Is DOC eligible to be considered, Department of Corrections, to be a member of this, given all the work they do in this area?
Yeah, DOC has certainly been represented. I'm not sure why they're not actually included on the bill. I don't know. Marie, Cindy, do you have any thoughts on that?
We'd be happy to be part of the task force.
Okay.
I have no
idea why that would be, actually. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would like to see at least some, as we had some folks come in who had been incarcerated, I'd like to also at least perhaps have some folks who are alumni of OYA to be part of this discussion, because this kind of thing affects folks, younger people, in a different way, and I think it would be a good thing for us to have them just part of this. In whatever way we can do that, mm-hmm. doesn't have to be necessarily as an official member, but that's a viewpoint I'd like to see.
Okay, great. Yes, Paul.
Maybe someone from Oregon Housing Community Services, or just thinking about the housing aspect.
Mm. Yeah.
Elizabeth had something to
say. Elizabeth?
Who is the housing person?
Deborah MC.
Oh, sorry. And then there's nobody related to families or children, and not that children matter, but I don't know if we want to talk about the broader issue of restoration, familial relationships, or anything like that. Is there something, if we're talking reentry, or is there a different sort of service provider, for example, who might be helpful? And I don't know the answer to that. There's a component that seems to be missing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Probably DHS for that?
Yeah, either DHS or a nonprofit that works in this area probably makes sense. Okay.
How well are we represented in the education area? I don't know.
Well, we have Eddie Alves, who's, he has a real focus on education programs within within the prisons, and we're well represented with him.
We have apprenticeship, so we've got.
Mm-hmm. What about the Bureau of Labor and Industry?
Foley itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we can't have all the agencies here. But yes, something to think about.
Senator?
Yeah. Yes, Eddie.
I've been trying to reach out because I'm in a rural community, so housing issues are different here. I've reached out to OIA over in Burns and talked to them a little bit about their education and some of their issues. And so I think it's important that that we don't forget a lot of these rural communities have significantly, I think, different issues for housing and transportation than some of the metro areas.
Mm-hmm. Very good point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, great, thank you. Okay. So if you think of some other things, over the next week or two, just send an email to me or to Cheyenne. It would be great. Okay, the driver's license suspension reform issue, you'll remember, or those of you who are here for the first time, we've discovered a real challenge that ex-offenders face where they lose their licenses, and the suspension is due not to anything related to their driving, but to other reasons, and that's creating real barriers for employment and also for them fulfilling their family responsibilities, et cetera. And this is an issue we've learned that is a national issue, and that the national association that represents motor vehicle departments is pushing for change here to have those non-driving offenses not be a cause grounds for suspension. And it seems like something that really we should be pursuing. So that's what this bill is doing. And the drafting on that, the initial drafting, is pretty much complete. Our legislative counsel has been doing a great job of going through the statutes and looking at what would be affected. And it's now, at the point that, so the only things that would remain as grounds for suspension would be those that are driving related or that are required by federal law. So there's not really a way to get around that. And we're at the point now of running that by DMV, our DMV, to see, are we missing anything? And so that should be ready to be shared with you very soon. Any questions about this or thoughts about this issue?
I'm just curious, Paul, if you anticipate any opposition around this particular bill or whether you think it's kind of a slam dunk.
I've heard a lot of positives about this, but once it's out there, of course, it'll probably attract negatives. I'd like to get it out there as soon as possible so that we can find out pretty early on what are the problems and try to figure out how to address those. We learned that Washington has a bill that they passed in 2013 that so far, I think, has been, they didn't indicate that there have been problems. Let me back up and say that they, I think this is the bill, yes, they passed it in 2013, but left the decisions for what would be included and what wouldn't be to their DMV, to the agency for rulemaking. And so that has taken them some time, and their preference would be not to have to do it, but to have us do it. And so we're trying to be as clear as we can in the drafting so that the rulemaking on this should be fairly straightforward.
Yeah. I think it's a great initiative. I was just looking through my numbers earlier today on the number. We also run reconnaissance in Multnomah County and the number of people on supervision, and this is why they're getting brought, because of driving while suspended. It's not related to their.
Right. Yeah, Washington called their bill the driving while poor bill, you know, because often it's just a lot of it is financial restraints that are that are the cause of the suspension, and then people are driving anyway, and then they're being brought back into the system, which, you know, we in the Motor Vehicle Agency head report, you know, they point out some of the costs involved in that. The costs of policing, the costs of unnecessary stops, you know, and what that can lead to, and then you know, also just the cost of retrying people. So,
as I recall, this was an incredibly large percentage of the folks who were going through Clean Slate when it was up and running, because there were a lot of people who. We're dealing with that, looking over their shoulders every time they went to work. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. The certificates of rehabilitation, you know, I've been getting a lot of positive feedback about this concept when I've talked to various people, and just to remind you that the goal here is there are a couple of goals. One is this as a sort of logical follow-up to the Ban the Box bill, where the Ban the Box bill is a way for an ex-offender to not be barred for getting an interview, right? So they get an interview, and then that's their opportunity to make the case for themselves. But in order to help them to make the case for themselves that, yes, they are, you know, they're worth investing in, you know, taking the employing, and that they're being open about the reasons for their incarceration, but they... they're now ready for the employer to hire, and it, you know, I've been speaking to different employers who've said they would really value having something like this, you know, as they're making the hiring decision, you know, because, you know, right now the individual comes in and makes the case for him or herself, but. You know, and I just spoke with a large employer this morning about this, and they said, you know, we want to hire ex-offenders, and the ex-offenders tell us the circumstances of their offense and where they are now, and we want to believe them, but we don't know if we can believe them. And so having some sort of validating mechanism would really be of value to them. And, Brian, I don't know if you want to say any more about this. From your perspective, Mercy Corps has been piloting a program that's kind of similar to this. And, you know, one of the challenges that we will face as we design this program is how is the determination made to, you know, to grant their certificate of rehabilitation? What's the process? Who does it? What's the most cost-effective way of doing this, and the least intimidating for the offender, et cetera?
Yeah, we recently met with Home Forward, where the pilot properties are accepting the certificate of good standing. We have some individuals who have actually obtained it. And it's a skeleton committee now that reviews it and makes sure they meet the criteria and they're issuing it. From the housing side, which I would anticipate would be the same concerns I'm hearing about the employer side, is who's validating this? Who is maintaining it or making sure that they're still eligible and in compliance with all the criteria to receive this? And they're looking, you know, on the housing side, there's a couple extra pieces we're talking about putting in. One is for the housing side to make sure they have renter's insurance, and a particular kind of renter's insurance where the landlord can initiate a damage claim on behalf of the client if there's the catastrophic, I think there's a camera in my sprinkler head, so I'm going to smash it, flood the floor. You know, I mean, those were their words, that those are the things they're concerned about, as well as anything that would ever, you know, horribly injure anyone. I mean, they have some valid concerns, and I'm sure employers have the same thing about hiring somebody and then having an accident or an incident. So that's something that, you know, looking through some of the materials you shared with me, and I saw the when they do a background check at that point through the state police, and they'd be able to say, yes, this person has it. But creating that oversight is definitely going to be the piece that gets everybody interested in, like, how is this determined? The criteria can be set, but how do we determine that somebody is still eligible for this criteria? And the penalties are being a violation for using it falsely. Those are the kind of mechanisms I think that are going to help landlords and help eventually employers take this seriously and know that it's somewhat vetted, that these are people that not just met these criteria when we gave it to them, but what is the oversight to make sure they're still eligible moving forward? Is there anybody that does a renewal at a year? Another piece that came from the housing providers was they legally can't ask if somebody's still engaged in mental health or substance use treatment. They can't ask if they're active in their own personal choice of a recovery program. So they're looking for that interim quasi-agency that can verify those things and be the clearinghouse for that kind of information to validate that, yes, this person still not only meets the criteria, but they're moving further and further back into fully reintegrated and compliance and off paper and back to the same level ground as everybody else that doesn't have these barriers that we're trying to mitigate. So there was quite a bit of discussion about adding the rental insurance as part of it. And there was also the discussion about some of the criteria, especially on the housing, is so stringent that a lot of the properties with the new federal fair housing laws, people may not be getting rejected just because of criminal behavior in the past with landlords that are following the letter of the law and with some of the new federal laws around fair housing. It's making less of a gap between what people are able to address with particular criminal activity in their past to getting into apartments. So still the need exists, and landlords have been receptive to rent well and the rent guarantee that's behind that. I think the biggest points that people would focus on here is not only is there a state agency issuing this certificate, but is there oversight? Is there a renewal? Is there a probationary period they get it? And then after a year, they get a full, how long is that good for? But really, who is monitoring to make sure? I mean, obviously, we have any new offenses that would interrupt it. Because we asked at our two meetings ago of the Restoration Opportunity Act up in Washington, how do they verify that somebody, if they've given them back their occupational license, is still in compliance? And their only catch-all was only if they commit a new act that would suspend their occupational license. So with the issuance of a license, it gets a little more personal when you're renting to somebody and in the housing, that they want to see somebody say, yes, in a year we're going to review this, or this is renewed this often. We're the agency responsible for verifying that there's no new criminal activity, you know, relapse or whatever categories you want to look into it as far as ensuring people that these are safe tenants to rent to. The criteria enough is a pretty good indicator. I think it was written far enough out with being out a year and a half And the letters of support and the completion of rent well and gainful employment or lawful support, I think we're really close to something that more and more landlords would be interested in accepting.
Okay, yeah. Scott?
This is Deborah Ensley.
Yes, Deborah, hi.
Hi, I just thought to weigh in a minute. I thought many of the points that were just made.
Deborah? Yeah, we kind of lost you.
It's all the way up.
Oh.
There she is.
Okay. Trent, could you say that again? We're not hearing you, Deborah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
Oh, okay. So I was going to say, many of my members have voiced similar concerns that were pointed out, and so I think that's really great. I did want the group to know that currently in Chapter 90, landlord-tenant law, landlords cannot require renter's insurance for potential renters whose median family income is under 50%. So that's just something that there needs to be aware of.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Scott?
I was just wondering, in your discussions of this, as part of 3194, we have the ability to do an earned discharge for people who actually are complying with everything and doing everything. And so for this population, that ending of your supervision and everything is an indication that you've completed your fees, fines, treatment, done all that. So it might be at least added to the list of things that would indicate compliance and good standing, because you have to do all that before we'll let you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a monitored period of time that might be valuable to employers or renters.
Right. And just to kind of review, Brian, with the Mercy Corps pilot program, there's a panel that includes, for example, an ex-judge or a retired judge, retired probation officer, assistant district attorney, or?
There's quite a mix on the board.
Okay.
The executive director of JOIN, some housing partners that look at the criteria and are awarding the certificates now based on meeting the criteria, and it's a consensus base at this time. Which again is, you know, sufficient now for our pilot, but eventually it would be nice to have other organizations know exactly how to access it. I mean, we have the forms on our website people can get. They know how to prepare them. Most people that have completed RentWell have the majority of the requirements in their portfolio that is part of your completion of RentWell, with the exception of maybe a couple letters of recommendation and some updated employment information. And people can resubmit their credit scores, which have hopefully improved. So they do have a panel of a pretty good mix of people that are willing to volunteer to make sure that the criteria is being met and award them on that basis at this time. But again, that would be something we'd look to standardize.
Paul? So, Brian, is there a process in place for revoking them or reviewing them to address that issue of long-term compliance? Because I think there are a lot of details in figuring out how to do something like this, and I think you've kind of hit on the oversight as being one of the more challenging aspects of rolling something like this out statewide. So I'm kind of curious if that's a piece that you guys have figured out.
It's a piece that's just been identified. Currently, I think the catch-all to that is that to use it without being currently meeting the criteria, it's an actual violation of a mild criminal offense.
Mm-hmm.
To use it. So we're looking for something in between the two so that people can't use it before they're not eligible for it. Someone to do the oversight and maintain the certificate's eligibility standing for individuals. So yeah, it's been identified, but currently not a component that we've been able to wrap around yet. And we're not poised to be that agency quite yet. So but we'd like to partner on it and structure it where it's satisfying the landlords, especially to have them know that there's some sort of oversight agency that's making sure that people are still eligible for it and are still in compliance with all the criteria. But it's just part of what we think would make it more successful and more appealing. And thank you for the note about the less than 50% of the federal family poverty level and not being allowed to require that, because I will mix that in at our next discussion.
Okay, great.
Senator Denbrough?
Yes.
This is Nova. Can I make a comment?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I released, for those of you who don't know, I released from Coffee Creek in February of 2015, and so I am over my halfway mark, although I was one of the people that was eligible for an early release program, so I actually haven't, I was in the community 90 days as Department of Corrections custody, so I'm not technically, according to House Bill 3194, considered a halfway mark person yet. So I'm waiting on that moment to happen, because I have been in complete compliance with all my parole guidelines. I'm on the lowest supervision level, yada, yada, yada. I have a master's in social work and a master's in criminal justice, so I've recently decided to try and go back into my field, which is working with vulnerable populations. And in doing so, I was hired by, where I live is in Corvallis in Benton County. I was hired by the Benton County Health Department to be a peer recovery mentor. I passed their entire credentialing process. I was completely forthcoming about my criminal background and what I've done since then and what I plan to do to continue in my recovery and not be a risk to people, to the well-being of a vulnerable population. I had to go through this extensive background check with the state of Oregon. So all of the same information was sent off to the Office of Human Resources and the Oregon Health Authority. And on Monday, I received the notice of final fitness determination. I've been denied. I've been denied the credentialing process by the state to work with as a peer recovery mentor with other adults in the same situation because, I'm not exactly sure why. I think the main reason is probably because they still see that I'm on parole and I still have this other, I still need 3194 to come through for me, so I am removed from parole. But there's something very wrong with what's going on for those of us who have, I have a professional career that I'm trying to get back into, and I'm not able to find enough support. And I don't know exactly what to do, but this is bigger than people that are working at jobs, blue collar jobs. This is a bigger issue in this credentialing process. For me, I'm super invested in it, and I think this is a really big subject. I just wanted to share that.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Nova. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, we, as the bill request has gone in, we are requesting that it be similar to Washington in that it does have the potential to restore licensure and credentialing. And so we have to figure out exactly how to make that happen.
Right. So I would take a look at what the DHS has going on. The OARs 125-007-0270 all the way up through -0290, because they have very specific reasons in there that can disqualify a person from actually working with disadvantaged populations.
Right. I remember the enactment of that legislation. Paul?
Yeah.
Senator Denbrough, can you remind us in the Washington version who was responsible for providing oversight? Because I really feel like, this failed or didn't pass the last time this went through for a variety of reasons, and I think part of it had to do with the structure.
Right.
So it would help me to get behind this if I knew a little bit more about exactly how we're trying to roll this out.
As I think I indicated, this is very much a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And one of my goals today was to just let you know that this is in process and to see, you know, which of you has a particular interest in this issue, who'd like to work with me on developing this. That would be very helpful. I think Justice DeMunis still has an interest in this issue and would like to, you know, would like to work on it. And so I'd like to assemble a subcommittee, as it were, of this task force who have a particular interest to work on developing this over the next couple of months. So please let me. Okay. So, yeah, so let me know if this is something you want to work on. Okay, anything else about the certificates? Okay, then the Bill of Rights, we discussed this at the last meeting, that this was going to be coming, and this is modeled after Bill of Rights in San Francisco and a couple of other jurisdictions, and the you know, the initial drafting just uses that existing Bill of Rights that would then be you know, incorporated into this bill, but we are working on developing that list and also how this would be used. And so you know, I've been working with the YWCA and the people active in the Family Preservation Project to convene a group of stakeholders to talk about, okay, so if we have this Bill of Rights, then how do we, what do we do with it? I mean, certainly there's value in sharing it with the children of incarcerated parents, let them know that, you know, we are, you know, we care about them, we want them to be advocating for themselves, but how exactly will this be implemented on the ground? That's, you know, we need to have a conversation about that, around that. But clearly, I think there's probably broad agreement that we need to be considering the needs of the children, of the incarcerated parents, but how exactly we can turn that into productive practice, I think that's kind of the next step. Anybody have any thoughts about this or reactions?
I have a question.
Yes.
How far along is the Children's Bill of Rights? Now, this is focusing on children of incarcerated parents.
Correct.
How far along is that?
Well, it's in its early stages.
Is there like a little draft or something that someone's got a hold of? That
We don't have a draft yet. What we do have is the initial language, which is from the San Francisco ordinance. And so, you know, you can Google that and just...
It's also available on OLIS.
Yeah, we put it on our website. Yes, great.
And it looks like a lot of the language is from the Foster Children Bill of Rights.
It's similar.
And one of the lessons from that is how do we make sure it's approachable, it's usable in this new format for incarcerated children's parents.
That's right. Elizabeth, yeah. I know you have a real interest in this.
Yeah, I really do. So I think the most important piece of this is making sure that we have an education component to the immediate. You know, there's essentially two sets of people who should be involved as you go through the Bill of Rights, and I don't know if that includes, and I hate to say this, a monetary ask to make sure that there is space in there so that it is not just a titular Bill of Rights. It is actually something that is distributed and understood in throughout the process. So just continuing to say we need an education component that goes with this Bill of Rights.
Hi, this is Kylie with the YWCA. I realized I was talking and I was on mute, so my apologies. The other piece that we're also looking at with that bill has to do with a work group that existed in the early 2000s called the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project. And they had to report to the legislature a whole kind of host, a very comprehensive list of recommendations, many of which are those kind of steps that Senator Dembo was talking about, the things that need to happen to actually make sure that those rights are being recognized and realized. So part of what's happening right now is we're developing what that bill might contain is how might we reinvigorate that group or those recommendations, because a lot of work already went into those, a wide group, a very large table of folks came together and came up with them. And so there might be some, might behoove us to link up with those recommendations and figure out how we move forward. And I agree with Elizabeth absolutely about making sure that we have that education training component to be looked at as well. And then as far as the actual list, it is on OLIS, but there's also the group, if you Google San Francisco Children's of Incarcerated Parents Bill of Rights, it has a whole host of information about each of the rights and sort of a drop-down description of what each one of those can mean in different jurisdictions or as far as different agencies or entities. So there's a lot of information out there.
Great. Thank you, Kylie. There's also you know, the question of ongoing oversight, you know, to make sure that actually the, you know, the rights of the children are being respected. And, you know, do we need to have, as we have a foster youth ombudsman, do we need an ombudsman for the, you know, for these children? You know, I don't know. I don't know that we're in a position to create, you know, such an office, but it's something, I think, for us to think about. There seems to be about a 10% overlap, we've heard, between these children and children in foster youth, in foster programs. So there is some overlap, but it's certainly not complete overlap. So this is a, you know, this is a different population to some extent. Okay, so let's move on to Bill 5, the Family Preservation Project expansion. And there are a couple of pieces to this. And, you know, the people who work in the FPP world are themselves looking at what kind of expansion is needed, what would the dollars buy. Obviously, we'll need dollars to expand, and that's going to be a function of what our budget looks like next session, which is a real unknown right now. But, you know, one question that also is out there, whether or not, whatever our budget situation is, right now there's not really an agency that houses the Family Preservation Project budget. It was a special allocation that came at the end of the session, and so it's technically within the Department of Administrative Services budget. But you know, there are conversations happening. Is there some place where this should actually be housed, or does it have to be reinvented each biennium? That seems like something we would want to avoid, it seems to me. But the question becomes, where is the right place for this, you know, for this program? Yes, Scott.
And trying to help think that through, when you folks were talking about this in the past, have you also been talking about expanding it closer to the Washington model, where we could bring out women and men with children early?
Yeah. Right, because right now it's just a front end project. In the original discussions, there were two components to it. There was an early release component on the back end, and there was kind of more of a diversion project on the front end, and they adopted the front end piece of it.
It just seems to me, with the current threat looming over you and everything, and the potential of the women's prison for us in Multnomah County, this would have been a population that we could identify that are already getting programming and going through, and then when they have children, be able to bring them out early and take advantage of that programming, the parenting, and set up a whole wraparound bringing them out. And you'd be avoiding the extensive cost given the volume when we look at some of this. So I'm just asking, as you look at this act, are you staying within the current framework of it, or is that a possibility? Because I think DOC does a very good job with the variety of parents once they're ready to reassess that priority. They're very, it makes it a lot easier for us in the field to work with when I have that kind of motivation helping people change their lives. So I just...
That's a great point. I don't know enough to know anything about that, but it's, that sounds good to me.
Well, I just say, I pick up women from Coffee Creek all the time, and they have women, they have children that are in, you know, DHS custody, and they're struggling with these issues. And so a lot of what has been happening with the diversions and the early release of parents, and yes, DOC does a wonderful job with the Parenting Inside and Out program and all that. But ultimately, when someone goes to prison, it's up to the district attorney. And so it's almost like providing that safety net for if a parent does not get into the diversion or there's no room for treatment and the judge sends someone to prison because they're literally trying to save their life and there's no treatment, so they think, well, you'll get it in prison. I just picked up a girl with that exact situation. And she should have never been in prison. And so it's almost like with the DOC and with the family preservation, having almost a safety net for the women who don't get to the benefit of, or men, you know, the family preservation expansion and goals and stuff. So it's having something, you know, run and managed by DOC, like an alternative incarceration program or like a parenting boot camp. I know they used to have boot camps and stuff. And they have some stuff in like California and Washington where parents are able to take more of a hands-on role. And it's a lot easier to transition. It's a lot easier to release them early once they've shown, you know, like I say, we don't need foster homes, we need parenting coaches. Instead of putting the kids in foster homes and the parents in jail or prison, send in super nanny. I wish I had one. But, you know, it's just, that's why I say I would really like to take this opportunity to kind of think outside, because I am a formerly incarcerated person, and I did go through all of these programs, and we didn't have half of this stuff when I got out 13 and a half years ago, and it's, I've, you know, been able to utilize what was at my fingertips. But this is exciting stuff, and I'm really happy that you guys let me sit in.
Thank you, Christine. Yes, Elizabeth.
I just want to make sure that when we're thinking about this, we make sure that the infrastructure is there for an expansion. Because I heard from our last meeting and some of the women who had been through the Parenting Inside program that those rooms are no longer available to them. Now the rooms are part of the cafeteria and other things are going on, and there's not... So right now it feels like things are being squished in terms of infrastructure for the existing population. And so I just want to make sure that if we're going for expansion, we're expanding not just the number of bodies, but the infrastructure that made that success possible to begin with. So just
this is Nova, and I'd like to piggyback on that. She's absolutely correct that when I was at Coffee Creek not too long ago and a part of the Family Preservation Project for 18 months, we were allowed to have our program in what the minimum site calls the programs building, which is responsible for all the GED classes, the computer technology class, the church services. There's several, there's yoga that goes on over there. There's several rooms that are divided off by divider walls that can be pulled back. And so on the first and third Saturdays of every month, the Family Preservation Project basically took over that building those mornings because there was nothing going on. The employees of the program supervised all the women and children. They did all the count times. They were responsible for everything. So no security staff was involved, nothing. Well, since the DOC shut the program down and then they were reinstated, the security staff and Captain McCorkill have insisted that the Family Preservation Project not be back in that program building. We have made them be in the cafeteria, which is right next to the hub, the bubble, where the security staff can, they have a line sight to the moms and the children. It's where all the inmates eat their lunches, and it's on a hard linoleum, dirty floor. It's completely inadequate. So they're trying to expand the program in a smaller space that has less therapeutic value. And so it is a problem. But this is not, this is something that on the front lines inside Coffee Creek Correctional Facilities, they are pushing back. And Ms. Katz has had numerous meetings with the security staff trying to get us back in that area, and she's not getting anywhere.
Nova, thank you so much for that. Sorry, I just sent you a friend request on Facebook, too, by the way. But that is the perfect piggyback onto what I've been kind of talking to people about, is that the space. Now, Captain McCorkill, if she says that she doesn't want it in there, it's not going to be in there. And so if you're going to have it over in the minimum side, that's the cafeteria. So that's going to be severely limited. Now, we have the old women's prison that was not originally built as a prison. It was more of a like a treatment facility. It has wooden doors. There's not the concrete and bars. And I suggested that we utilize that space. I mean, if they've got $1 million right now going in to kind of give it a makeover, I say we give it a family-friendly makeover, and we revolutionize the way that we incarcerate parents with children. And so with OSP being next door, we just set the dads over there and the women, you know.
The general population on the middle of the side is the women who were either not eligible or weren't moms yet, or maybe had decided not to be moms anymore. They had this, it was this cause and effect where it made a positive environment for everybody. And my 3 years there, I really noticed a general sense of like support for the program. And even if you weren't directly related, it caused other people to act better, to be more respectful. To care about the facilities more. And I don't, that could just be in my head, but I think that there's something to be said. I hear what you're saying about remodeling that area, but I also think there's collateral damage in a good way for people that aren't in that program to see these other women changing their lives.
Yes, Paul. For a second, I mean, I think I'm a little bit lost here. It seems like what we're talking about has nothing to do with what's going on in the institutions. I mean, we're talking about a probationary program right now that could be expanded that has nothing to do with corrections and potentially doing something on the back end where people would receive programming after they get out of prison. So I just want to kind of clarify.
And if we were able to do that,
right,
it might affect the population crunch,
right,
and begin to free up space. And right now, the only mechanism for that is the short-term transitional leave. And there's been all sorts of work done by the Criminal Justice Commission on different space creation, and this is just a different, as one of the pilots, that's one of our issues in Multnomah County, is I know we have women in the prison that we could bring out and work with, but instead we have to wait. And it really, in this model and in this time, is not serving a purpose that we benefit from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is Kylie again. I wanted to say that I really appreciate some of the points that have been brought up, some of which we've been thinking about, some of which we need to expand our thinking to include. I think what we're at the base of the foundation of what we're really trying to do is to make sure that the program continues. I think figuring out what that expansion could look like and whether or not you could go back or which ways making it deeper, I think that primarily we're just trying to first think about what's the best mechanism for continuing to fund this program that's been around for 10, 13 years and has been really successful. So I think I really appreciate the thoughts and the comments about what are the ways that would, if we're going to spend it, what might be most helpful and most impactful, and at the same time thinking about how do we make sure that we can even get to the point where we can be talking about expansion.
Thank you, Kylie. Cindy, Marie, do you have anything you want to say about this? from a DOC perspective?
The only thing I'm aware, I do know Senator Shields has been meeting with a work group to talk about some of these very issues, and one of them being the Bill of Rights, and the other one being Family Preservation Project. So I haven't been involved in those meetings. Yeah. Other DOC representatives have.
Yeah.
But I know they're also talking about this as well.
But, yes, that's right. And I've kind of inherited that.
Oh, okay.
And Representative Frederick was at one of these meetings, too. Okay.
They recently met again.
Right.
I know that they were talking about where the responsibility lies, if it belongs with DHS, you know, who should have oversight over that. So there are ongoing discussions.
That's right.
But, yeah, I don't have minutes from the last meeting that just took place.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, so a work in progress. The final bill on the sheet is the pre-entry pilot, and those of you who were there were here at the last meeting. Alex Bassos from Multnomah County Defenders explained the program to us, and he is working with legislative counsel on what the bill would look like in terms of what would be needed. There'll be some kind of blank there for a budget allocation to actually do it, but the description and the nature is something that is being worked on. But, you know, roughly it's, you know, it will resemble what we looked at last time, and this is up on OLIS as well, isn't it?
The pamphlet about the program, yes.
Yeah, okay, great. Any questions about that, about the pre-entry? Okay. Lou, Frederick, you have a couple of things.
I have three bills, but one is more directly related to this particular committee. The other two tangentially. The first one is something regarding collections and the amount of the court fee issue that we've talked about in the past. We got close to discovering how to deal with this near the end of the 2016 session, but it was near the end of the 2016 session. So
it was a pretty short session.
Yes, but it was a matter. So we basically had to put it on hold. Had to put a stop on it right there. There are issues that we continue to have regarding control, and as you said, the complication of the different kinds of fees, who is responsible for them, fees related to court costs, fees. We are not talking about restitution fees. That's not part of the mix. It is talking about those court fees that various groups, various courts and others put on a conviction or on a defendant, that they come out of prison and discover that they may have several thousand dollars worth of fees that will start to accumulate interest and deal with a number of other things. So we're looking at that. And then the idea, the basic idea was to find a way to allow people using community service of one form or another to pay for those particular fees, and have an agency or a nonprofit group help create those kinds of spaces for people to be able to use that to pay off those fees, rather than having to try to find money that they simply do not have because they're still trying to find jobs, and not put them into the collections agency kind of a approach. In other words, not try to keep them as poor as possible. So that's part of what I'm working on. I will I have introduced another legislative concept to LC. They are looking over it, and they'll be able to use the amendments that we came up with at the end of the 2016 discussion. So that's what we hope to do. That's part of it. The other two, one is dealing with confiscated cash. What we've discovered is that people, when they go in, may have cash confiscated from them, and then they are often handed a debit card that they're charged for using each time. So they basically do not have the same amount of money that they came in with. So trying to find a way to deal with that kind of confiscation. And that, again, that bill is, these things are on OLIS right now, too, as I recall, right? You put them within the committee?
Not yet.
Not yet, okay.
But we could.
That would be fine. I don't mind.
Bills from the previous sessions?
No, no.
The basis for the redirect?
They were actually, when Sue sent you, what is it?
Sent the copies of the legislative requests and the backup material.
That's what I'm talking
about.
The previous
bills. All of that upload?
Yes, all that upload. That would be fine. So that'll be available. And finally, the third bill is dealing with something else that we discovered, and I understand that that Multnomah County DA is working on this right now. It is sort of disturbing. Someone will trespass on transit property is substantially more harshly dealt with than any other kinds of trespass. And disproportionately affecting people who are dependent on public transit. So you may get be told that you are violating an order saying that you are not supposed to trespass on transit property while you're on your way to deal with a court case dealing with transit property and dealing with trespass or dealing with another issue. And you can it's significantly more harsh a penalty than because it ends up being saying that you are interfering with the operator of the MAX or the train. Now, what they discovered at Multnomah County is that it was also disproportionate in terms of minorities and immigrants. And they have started to work on that particular issue. So it's also what I discovered in talking with people was that there were particular jurisdictions that were more harsh than others. Certain counties were much harsher about this than others. And so we need to figure out how to deal with that. I understand that I talked with Rod Underhill last week or the week before. And we had a good long conversation, and this was one of the issues that he brought up before I did, saying that they were in fact planning on trying to work on that particular issue. So those are the three that I'm looking at right now.
Great. Okay. Any questions for Lou?
Yes, Representative Frederick. So would the last one? I'm assuming it would reduce the penalties.
Reduce the penalties or redefine some of the what the charges are. I mean, what was happening was we had transit police and others who were deciding to use the much harsher penalty rather than what they could have done.
In our neck of the woods in Lane County, this has been a real issue as well, and a lot of it has to do with once people have been trespassed, the process of getting them reinstated, which can be somewhat arbitrary, I think.
That was brought up actually. That's why one of the reasons this is not just a metro area issue.
So somebody is trespassing if they have been barred from coming on to the MAX or told you can't use this.
Right, and trespass versus interfering with the use of a transit is that there are two different things.
Interfering with public transportation.
Pardon?
Interfering with public transportation.
Public transportation.
That's a much
harsher charge than just a trespass.
Yeah, so if they've been rowdy or something, then they're deemed you can't use public transit? Is that how it works?
Yes.
And who makes that determination?
Usually it's the Metro Transit officers.
Yep. TriMet hired their own prosecutor for this. My husband does light rail, and my best friend, sorry to interrupt, but I have some insight, and there's one way you can kind of stop that is that TriMet has funded their own prosecutor for this because they're trying to get ridership up to justify the Orange Line. Now, my best friend lives at the end of the Orange Line, so I know everything that goes on down there, and yes, people do get rowdy, and it does disproportionately affect minorities, people with mental health problems, the homeless. And now they're the ones because it's so much tougher on you know, transit property is because they're trying to get an increase of ridership and getting people to stop. You know, about 50% of people pay when they get on. That's what I've kind of gathered from my different discussions. But one thing is to say, well, maybe you don't need your own prosecutor. We need to maybe look at a different way of handling these people who get on transit property and have a meltdown.
Well, I'm not sure that it's not just the Orange Line. The issue issue that was brought up for me was primarily dealing with Washington County. So it wasn't going down the Orange Line. Right. It was specific. The first people talking about it were especially recent immigrants who often did not speak English or did not understand what was going on. They would get immediately and more harshly treated, even though they would say, "I don't speak English." They would still be harshly treated and find themselves unable to get back and forth. So this is part of the whole. This is why this discussion is underway.
Okay.
But tangentially related to what we're dealing with here, not completely.
Great. Okay. So what's missing in these in these bill concepts that we put in now? Is there anything that we had talked about that you all can remember that we have missed? I mean, we have talked about, the renter situation some, and that, I think, is work for the future. But I'm not sure that we came up with anything. That there was talk about perhaps the state taking on some responsibility for insurance, for renter's insurance. I don't know that we're at the point where that's something we should pursue or that we could pursue, but... just to remind you how the process works, these bills that we're talking about here were all pre-session filed. And so they were submitted by the end of September deadline, which means that they will be drafted in advance of the next session. In fact, they'll be available to us no later than mid-December. And then they can be filed and actually first read, that is formally introduced, on the first day of the new session. That doesn't mean that we can't submit additional bills, and they may well be ready in time for the beginning of the session, but there's not a guarantee that they will be at this point. But fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, this is a long session that we have coming up. And so there will be plenty of new bills generated over the course of the session, which is appropriate because we'll learn more and that there'll be, need for additional bills. Yes.
What are you guys working on as far as transitional housing? I know Mercy Corps is here. What's the transitional housing thing that you guys are working on right now for this? Is it just kind of the same where, like, Bridges to Change and Home for Good and stuff for those transitional houses, or?
I don't know, I don't know what's going on directly in the housing world.
Well, I meant
if there
for,
are specific
like,
legislative
acts
around transitional housing or supportive housing or anything in particular. I know that there will certainly be legislation around housing and around making housing more available to low-income Oregonians. For this population specifically, I don't know.
Senator, I do remember Senator Winters asking for an inventory at one of our last meetings from Department of Corrections, and Mike Schmidt collaborated on talking about getting an inventory of available transitional housing by county. Mm-hmm. I know she asked that to get started, and I think the gentleman that presented on the short-term transitional leave was undertaking getting a informal accounting of starting with an inventory that we're interested in to see where the greatest need is by county. So there's some work on investigating where that would be most needed by county. Because, mm-hmm. again, there's that rural versus metro, two different, completely different scenarios on funding and need.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if Senator Winters may have some legislation in. I know that Rep. Parrish has a few things she's working on. She hasn't pre-session filed them, but they're related to the work of this committee. Yeah.
Do you have any idea of how this population overlays with the TANF population? And the reason I'm asking that is that, you know, the DHS cuts budget is, you know, kind of terrifying to look at for a divorced out of poor and a TANF population and security and considerations, which go to housing as well. So I guess I don't obviously have a solution, but the idea of trying to step back and look at this more holistically and seeing, right now I'm just concerned even what we've got. And if this population overlays that population to a certain extent, it's another really good reason to prevent those cuts. Just
so. I'll do what I can. Thanks.
And I haven't been part of all of your discussion, so I'm just checking in on all of the licenses for work and certification that are removed because of conviction that have nothing to do with the crime you committed. Have you folks looked at it, that or any of that, the limitation for employment that back in the day was passed to punish you, but right now keeps people from going back into industries they could work in that are not related to criminal behavior? A year or so ago, the ABA put out a whole publication on all, by state by state, all the different certificates and licenses you cannot apply for or cannot have if you're convicted. And so since the committee works on employment also, I just wondered if you looked at any of those to see if they still have merit.
We have not. But I would certainly be interested in our looking at that, perhaps at our next meeting.
And you did indicate the creation of a subcommittee on the certifications and wanting to include other licensure as part of the certificate of restoration of rights or whatever it ends up being called, that it has the effect of allowing a person to obtain their licensure, and that's what the woman on the phone was talking about.
With that certificate, I would be re-allowed to be a
means to do that, taking that document, that certificate is supposed to trigger or enable your access to licensure, and that's part of that discussion.
Right.
Thank you.
Scott. Okay. Let's move on to the report. So, Cheyenne, could you remind us, so what needs to go into this report? What is this report?
This report, Mr. Chair, members of the task force, we can revisit the original language of the bill, but some of that is obviated because of the late appointments and the late start. And if those of you who were here from the beginning recall, there was a progress report filed on the due date that's called for in the bill, which was this time last year. December of 2015 was the report deadline, but the task force agreed to submit a memo, a progress report at that time, and then shoot for further down the line for a full report. So the current sunset date for the task force is the 31st of December. And I've started an outline just because I keep track of the notes and the discussion. And the senator was interested in polling everyone sort of for their takeaways, main points over the course of the meetings thus far, and not taking for granted that there would be an extension and filing a bill for that purpose. So it doesn't necessarily have to adhere strictly to the language of the bill. We've deviated already, and we do that, of course, using the legislative committee model by agreement of the members of the task force. So whatever the task force agrees is what goes in the report, however you like it. And there's a structure that we follow, and I can put it in the proper format that's required. It's a formality. So if you want to make recommendations and you agree that that's what you want to do, that's what goes in. If you want to recap the work that's been done, that's pretty typical. Have a background section.
You know, I think one of the real values of reports like this is to sort of create the frame, if you're submitting legislation, to create the sort of framework for the legislation that's being submitted so that, you know, the members can see, you know, a real sense of what exactly is the problem, what's the broad problem, and what kind of process has been used to come up with this legislation. You know, so it hasn't just come out of thin air. You know, it's actually, there's a, you know, a problem, and there's been a process to investigate how to address the problem or problems.
And a lot of task forces do just that, make a record that summarizes the whole process of meetings, and then you could make findings, and then you could include recommendations. And I can prepare it any way that you want. That sounds like a structure you want to move forward with. I can throw something together, and it can be a starting place. Or in time for the end of the year, in case the sunset is. It's confusing because in this particular instance with the delayed appointments, typically a task force would make its recommendations. And then the legislative request would be made based on being responsive to that. But in order to meet the pre-session filing deadline,
right,
the members have just taken the initiative to cover as much as they could. So it seemed a little backward, but we'll catch it up.
Yeah, I think that, you know, from my perspective, the hardest part of the report will be really identifying the problem. And, you know, because it's relatively easy to just kind of go over the record of what we've done, but in terms of really identifying what the problems that we're dealing with, that creates challenges. So, any help that you all can provide, you know, in terms of identifying the need that we have been trying to address. Would be, you know, certainly useful. You know, in the area of barriers to employment, you know, some of the things that we've talked about are the licensure issue, apprenticeship and barriers to apprenticeship, driving, you know, the challenges of driving. But what are some of the other things that any of you can recall related to employment?
Probably the ones that we've talked about at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the broadening it in terms of the question that you had about licensing. For other licenses was an important factor, but
and in the bones that I've started with, I took the cue from the Senate Bill 969, housing and employment, are the factors that the expender needs for stability and stability. Those two things are data shows they reduce recidivism the best, and the top two out of this group from listening so far that are inhibitors to housing and employment are debt, the gamut of debt issues. Because the task force covered all manner of debt, including things that they can't touch, like child support debt and the ability to obtain a reinstated driver's license. And the rest of the detail can be lumped under those two. Those were the top two, but there could be other things that are important to each of you that you might want to include under those broad umbrellas, or in addition to.
Mm-hmm. Brian?
I think some of the outcomes of, I joined late this year, but the pre-entry project, working on mitigating some of that financial wreckage going before people go in to mitigate what they face coming out, as well as the fees and fines issue, as well as some community service, all a clean slate sort of program to help people get those collections of, be avoided. And then with the licenses, it's a huge issue. People that were able to help get their licenses back have an enormous advantage over people that are relying on public transportation or limited to employment because they can't get their license. So, and also looking back to the DHS visit with their ability to mitigate child support just by getting knowledge of it now. I mean, it seems like there's been a lot of progress made versus before. It was a real process for people to modify their child support in the Department of Corrections, where now Coffee Creek gives them the means to do that, and it's a lot easier. And even if someone from the community just says, hey, this person's incarcerated, they, you know, eradicate that barrier from ever being. So again, with the pre-entry work, a lot of it will be hard to track because it's avoiding problems that now don't exist rather than fixing them. So it's a little upstream. But with the licenses and the fines and, you know, working on mitigating barriers at the front end of this, those are all things that will have real impact on reentry, if you ask me. So I feel like we've, you know, as, along with reestablishing occupational licenses and, you know, a certificate of good standing, getting rent well to more people, getting financial fitness to people before they come out, getting some curriculum in Department of Corrections along that rent well thread, that all the components they can complete while they're in there is great. Maybe they have to wait till they get out to do their 3 credit checks, but get people thinking about, you're going to need to be in the housing market, you're going to need to be in the employment market. What, you know, where's your master application? Where's a list of places you have lived in the last 10 years or worked, or your strengths and financial literacy and employment literacy, knowing how to use the internet to attach your application.
Right.
And your resume. So, I mean, there's just, those are things that I see people, that we work with people all the time on, that I think could be done sooner. I mean, it's tragic that people go in and don't have that experience. It's probably symptomatic of why they're in the system, is that they have those struggles to begin with, but we're not working that far upstream yet. We're, you know, we have to work with what we are facing, and those are some of the direct challenges I see. And a lot of them have been addressed just in the few months I've been a part of this task force.
Right. Yeah, early on, we also got a lot of information from DOC, you know, about, we had conversations about training programs, you know, inside the prisons and how they work, and some of the challenges that are faced with when inmates transition out in terms of getting that work experience recognized. And, you know, I think that's still some work to be done. One of the problems that surfaced had to do with people who might have had a training program in that they started in one part of the state, but then they come out and they want to go to a community college to continue those studies, but the programs don't really cohere very well. And so that's actually an issue that I brought up with the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, and they're working on that right now. So, you know, hopefully we'll have better, you know, integration and ease of transferring, you know, from one program to another, you know, where a student can show proficiency because of what they learned in while they were inside, and having that translate to credits into the in their new program. So I would say that the educational / training side is probably an area where we need to do more work as well. Yeah. Anything else? So we'll take a stab at this report and have it available for our next meeting, a draft available, and then we can, you know, fix it up and finalize it.
Senator Dembro, I'm sorry. I was trying to say something. I was on mute. This is Nova. I apologize.
Yes.
You guys talk about some great things. There's just one other thing, and I don't know how you measure this.
But this whole sense of, you know, those of us who have committed crimes and gone off and done our time and coming back to the community, we've destroyed a lot of trust, a lot of relationships, and there's something that needs to be done in reentry around rebuilding trust with people. And, you know, we can get all our ducks in a row, but we still have, you know, some of us still have this stigma on our shoulders, and I'm really fortunate not to necessarily have that in my community, but it's hard. And so I think with educating people, maybe giving more sort of benefits to employers or groups that are willing to take risks on convicted felons coming out, and like rewarding people who are willing to maybe change their perspective and look at this as more of a restorative process and a whole, you know, a whole community to help somebody get back on their feet, and just that whole process of trust and rebuilding relationships, I think are huge to reentry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's certainly true. And I think the extent to which employers can become champions for how this can work, I think there's real value in that. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I had a conversation with a large employer in Portland today. I won't name them, but they make a lot of bread. And we were talking about this issue. They're actually they're having a hard time finding workers, which is kind of bizarre in a sense, because this is, it's a unionized workplace. They start at $18, $20 an hour with benefits, but they're having problems finding workers to do this work. And so I asked them about, you know, ex-offenders, are they open to that? And they said, you know, that they definitely are, that they, you know, over the last few years, they've hired 4 ex-offenders, and 3 of them are still with them. The fourth, he had anger issues that just he could not, you know, he couldn't control. But they've, one of them is a shift supervisor now, and they've, you know, had a lot of success, actually. And so we were talking about how they can help spread the word, you know, that, you know, it is, you know, that these are potential employees that one should take a chance on.
Well, the state needs to lead the way there, too. As far as hiring in the state, I think we still have a problem.
Yeah, I'm sorry you mentioned that, Jim, because...
Sorry, I said
no. No, it's only... that's a piece of unfinished business that we've had. That's something that we've wanted to have as an agenda item, and maybe we'll try to work on that for the next session, or the next meeting. Actually, we've wanted to have someone from DAS come in and talk about that issue, and do we know how many ex-offenders are employed by the state? Should the state be the, you know, the model, actually, for what we're trying to achieve? And that was something that actually that was brought up at the Governor's Reentry Council at a meeting I was at. I don't know if you were there, Paul, but people said, you know, how can the public sector lead by example?
And I think that's one of the ways where we have fallen short with kind of ban the box legislation, is local government or state government has passed what I think has largely been symbolic legislation, you know, to try and model for the private sector, but the public sector should be doing more to lead the way in showing the private sector what should be done.
Well, we'll be sure to get that into the report, and perhaps see if we can get something set up for the next meeting as well.
Senator Denbrough?
Yes.
I'm not sure this fits into the report, but just talking about training,
So within regards to Coffee Creek and the new pre-apprenticeship program that, as far as I know, is still on schedule to start there, and the other types of training that they're doing within facilities management, keeping that very much on the front burner, I think, is important at this point, because we are starting to see success from that program and the work that we've done through Oregon Tradeswomen, just to get the simple concept of construction training into specifically the women's prison. And I reported earlier on the value of bringing construction training inside the prison does two things: is it increases the number of women working in the construction industry, which is something that absolutely has to happen on federal projects, on government projects. We need more women.
Right.
So bringing the training inside that facility, but we are starting to see the success of that. So Oregon Tradeswomen has recently, within the past several months, put four women through their program. I'm proud to say two of whom are looking at the carpenters. But we also, out of the Washington Correctional Center for Women, out of their pre-apprenticeship program that has been in place for about 12 years, we currently in the carpenters have two first-term apprentices that have recently graduated from that program. So bringing this pre-apprenticeship training inside of correctional facilities and specifically targeting women at this point, because we need to increase those numbers, we are already starting to see the increase in number of women who are coming out of these facilities and being able to be successful as carpenters. And I just want to make sure that it stays very much on the front burner. I've been working a lot on the driver's license issue, but just the simple concept of bringing training inside the facility and not only allowing it to be an option for training once they get out. And I don't know how that fits into the report or fits into the bill. Obviously, the more funding for training like that, the better.
Yeah, obviously.
It's a broad concept.
Obviously, having women or men come out with those skills and a direct pipeline to employment is going to help reentry. I think there's little doubt about that. It's great. Okay, so I think is there anything else that anyone would like to bring up? Otherwise, we can talk about the next meeting dates. Jen, did you have anything else that you wanted to talk about? And I have a note here, progress report.
Sure.
Did we just get that, or?
I met with Steve Sims, Director of Apprenticeship and Training for BOLI, about the provisional driver's license bill.
Oh, yeah.
There was a problem that we identified in terms of, in order to use that bill, someone has to already be a registered pre-apprentice or a registered apprentice. The catch-22 was that in order to become a registered apprentice or a pre-apprentice, you often have to have a driver's license, or it scores you higher in the application process. So that was the main thing that we identified.
The whole point of the bill was to get passed. Okay,
exactly.
Sorry.
So what I talked to Steve Sims about this because I knew he would have the key insight. One of his suggestions was to, rather than completely change the process for BOLI or the apprenticeships, was to possibly ask the court to start the process of reinstatement of their driver's license when they apply to an apprenticeship program. So an applicant would apply to an apprenticeship program. At that time, they can petition the court for a conditional court order that would allow them to begin that court process. The application process takes a long time. The court process takes a while. So rather than having them have to try to go through an apprenticeship and get in and get their license, have them apply to the apprenticeship program. An apprenticeship program could issue a verification that they could take to the court to begin the process. The court could issue a conditional court order that says if you do get accepted, so pending acceptance into the apprenticeship program, then here is your letter. Then they could take both a conditional court order and an official
apprenticeship registration letter from Boley to the DMV, and with those two documents, get their license reinstated. So that was Steve's suggestion, and Steve was going to meet with the Justice Department to find out if that was indeed something that the courts would be able and willing to do. At the time that the applicant would go before the court with their verification of being in the application process, they would also need to discuss and present some kind of repayment process, because that is also part of the language of that bill. But at that point, to start to discuss how they would repay, when they would start to repay. The bill actually is really generous on apprenticeship programs. It actually states that they don't have to start repaying fines and fees till they complete an apprenticeship program, which is about 4 years. But to let the court and the applicant decide what would be an appropriate time for them to start repaying, but have that be part of the process when they apply for the conditional court order.
Yeah.
So that's.
I will say that was probably misdrafting.
I'm.
The goal was sure. 6 months after completing a pre-apprenticeship program, they would, because presumably by then they would be apprentices, they'd be earning an income, they'd be able to start repaying. But yeah.
But if the language stayed as it is in the bill, it gives a lot of leeway to the court.
Right.
Otherwise, the language would need to be changed to 6 months after being dispatched to their first job as a registered apprentice. Because after pre-apprenticeship, they may not be dispatched to their first job within 6 months. It could take a little longer. It could take less. But to have that as a barrier, I think would inhibit some people from being able to use the bill as well.
Great. Well, if the upshot of all this is that we need to pass a bill to fix this, if this can't be done within the framework of the existing statute, we have a bill that's available to be used. But it would be nice if we could just move forward within the authority of the existing statute.
That's what Steve and I discussed, and he is working on fine-tuning the process. And I think that he coming in to the task force next month, or he said he would be available to come in to.
We were talking about that.
Discuss it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So, for our next meeting, we are looking at. So normally we meet on Thursday, but there are. Problems with the Thursday, the appropriate Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
People will be hopefully eating turkey or some other thing on the usual day, and the week Thursday the week before is a problem as well. So we're looking at Monday the 21st, if that's something that will work for people. And then in December, we have Thursday, December 15th is our task force day, which is when all legislative task forces will be meeting. So if we could plan on that, that would be great. So those next two meetings, Monday, December 21st, and
November
21st. November 21st and Thursday, December 15th. And then this task force will go into hiatus, formal hiatus, as we are looking at the getting the legislature to renew it. As I mentioned, with respect to the report, in November we'll have a draft for you, and then we'll finalize it in December. Okay.
Sounds good.
Well, great. Well, thank you all. I think productive for me, and informal, good informal, productive meeting. Thank you for all your feedback. And with that, we are adjourned. We are adjourned. And with that.